Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good afternoon, Shifu, friends in the Dhamma. Okay, over the past few weeks, I had explained the Ratana Sutta. The theme of the Ratana Sutta is the qualities or the virtues of the three jewels, the triple gem. And now I come to the second of what are considered the three most popular suttas, protective or blessing suttas, in the Southern Buddhist tradition. I come to the second of these suttas, which is called the Mangala Sutta, or sometimes the Mahamangala Sutta. This might be translated the Discourse on Blessings, or the Discourse on What is Auspicious. And this discourse, I would say, presents what is, in the Southern Buddhist tradition, considered a complete course of education in the proper conduct of life, the right path of life, all the ways from the initial stages right through to the attainment of the final goal. The Mangala Sutta is used as a basis for education in the Dhamma schools throughout the Southern Buddhist world, in Sri Lanka, Thailand, Burma, so that children, when they go for their Buddhist Sunday school, they're taught the right way of life through the Mangala Sutta. And it teaches them the right conduct of life from the very initial stages, the most basic steps, embracing wider and wider circles. It unfolds through family relations, social relations, right attitudes of mind, right religious means of cultivation, until it reaches its final verses, the right way of meditation practice, right objects of contemplation, final realization, and final liberation. The sutta is also used in many monasteries as a theme for sermons. And the way it's used as a theme for sermons, the Mangala Sutta sets out what are called 38 blessings, 38 mangalas. And so in many monasteries, when the Mangala Sutta is taken as a theme for sermons, each week one of these blessings will be taken as the theme for the sermon. And in this way, if weekly discourses are being given, the Mangala Sutta can be spread out over 38 weeks. Sometimes, if it's treated in a more concise fashion, one stanza will be treated per week. In this way, it can be dealt with in, I think, 9 or 10 weeks. I'll try to go through it somewhat more quickly than that, since I want to go through the whole Sutta Nipata. If I went through that Mangala Sutta in detail, then we wouldn't get to the rest of the Sutta Nipata for a very long time. Okay, the title of the sutta, the word Mangala, in India had the meaning of something considered good luck, good fortune, something which is a sign or indication that a person is going to have good luck on a particular day or in a particular period in his or her lifetime. In American culture, to give you some idea of what are some typical mangalas, they say if you are walking in a field and you come across a four-leaf clover, that would be a mangala, because clovers typically have three leaves. And so it's very seldom that one comes across a four-leaf clover. But if one finds one, it's considered a sign of good fortune. They say you're going to have good luck that day. Many people carry on their keys, they carry their keys around. On the other end of the keychain, they have a rabbit's foot. Why do they have a rabbit's foot? You ask them, there's a belief the rabbit's foot is a sign of good fortune. What a rabbit's foot has to do with good fortune, nobody knows. There's no scientific explanation for it. But people believe this, and so when they have their keys, the other end, they'll have a rabbit's foot. People used to have it, maybe in the countryside, they still have over the door of the house, they have a horseshoe. Why is that? There's belief the horseshoe is a sign of good luck. There are also other mangalas, signs of bad luck. They say you come across a black cat, means you're going to have a bad day. Meeting a black cat has to do with having bad fortune? No scientific explanation. But this is what people believe. Or they say if you step out of the house and you hear the sound of a certain bird, crow or something, the raven, it's a sign of bad luck. These are some examples from American culture. It's very, very widespread in Indian culture too, Sri Lankan culture. I don't think you have anything like that in Chinese culture, do you? You mean with 2,500 years from the wisdom of Confucius, the wisdom of Lao Tzu, couldn't overcome these kind of beliefs. Okay, so in India, in the time of the Buddha, one time it said that a group of people in a particular town, the town of Savatthi, had met to have a discussion. What is a mangala? What is the sign of good fortune, the indications of good fortune? And so one group of people said, when you see certain things with the eyes, you see a particular color, a beautiful green color or a particular shade of red color, that's the sign of good luck. Or you step out of the house in the morning and you see a bird called the bird of paradise, that's the sign of mangala. Or you see a particular cloud formation, that's a mangala. Other people had different opinions. They said, no, a mangala is not something you see, the mangala is something you hear. If you step out of the house and you hear the song of a particular bird, that is a mangala, a sign of blessing. Or you hear the wind blowing in a particular rhythm, that is a mangala. Or you hear a song, maybe a village girl singing a particular song, that is a sign of good blessing, of blessings, good fortune. And so the debate went on back and forth. Then the news about this debate spread to other villages, other towns, till people all over were debating what is the indication of good fortune. And then this is the way the commentary explains it. They don't like to keep events tied down to the mundane human world, but the commentary likes to give the events a cosmic significance. So it says that when this debate was raging amongst human beings, the devas first the gods, the lower gods, were listening in, and they started to debate amongst themselves, what are the indications of good fortune? Then from one level of the devas up to the next level, up to the next level, till all of the devas were debating with each other, what are the indications, the signs of good fortune? Then finally, Saka, who was the king of the devas, decided to send one of his retinue down to the Buddha to ask the Buddha, what is the true sign of good fortune? And so the sutta begins with this event, when a deva, a being from the heavenly world, comes down to visit the Buddha. And so we now come to the sutta. For those who have the book, we're now on page 29. Okay, thus have I heard, once the Buddha was living near Savatthi in the Jeta grove at Anathapindika's monastery. Then one beautiful night, a certain devata, having illumined the whole Jeta's grove with surpassing splendor, came to the Buddha and, making salutation, stood on one side. Then that deva addressed the Buddha in verse. And I should explain that the Buddha had a very tight daily schedule. He had many duties to perform in the course of the day, teaching the monks and the nuns, going on alms round, then having periods for his own meditation, then giving discourses to the lay people who would come to the monastery. But he reserved a particular period in the depths of the night when everybody else was sound asleep. He reserved this period, a couple of hours, very late at night, perhaps between midnight and 2 a.m., for the devas to come to him. And so, when everybody is asleep, the monastery would be completely quiet. Sometimes the devas would come descending from the deva world, shedding bright, luminous radiance over the whole of the monastery, and they would come to the Buddha, bow down to the Buddha, because the Buddha, though a human being, is greater than even the greatest of the devas, and then they would ask him their questions. And so this deva comes to the Buddha and asks this question. And I'll recite the question first in Pali. It's not so much a question as a request. Bahu deva manusacha mangalani achintayum akanka manasotanam bruhi mangalamuttamam. So the deva says, many gods and human beings wishing for well-being or wishing for security have pondered, thought over those things that constitute, here he uses the expression I don't like, auspicious performances. I would say rather auspicious signs, signs of good fortune. Tell us, what is the highest sign of good fortune, the highest sign of the auspicious? Okay, now the Buddha, in a sense, turns the question of this deity on its head. Because when the deity is asking the question, He is thinking in terms of the common sense notion of what is good fortune. You know, what is a lucky sign? What is an indicator of good luck? But the Buddha is going to use the principles of the Dhamma, of his own teaching, to indicate that the sign, the indicator of true good fortune is not relying upon any external indicators of good luck or good fortune, but it's rather following the principle of cause and effect, the principle of conditionality, establishing the conditions, establishing the causes that lead to one's own good fortune, to one's own success, and to enable one to bring good fortune and success and well-being to others. In other words, here the Buddha is dispensing with, disposing of all superstitious notions of good fortune, and he's relying strictly upon this principle of conditionality. It's a principle which is based upon the idea of dependent origination, conditionality, and it teaches self-reliance, personal dependency. One doesn't depend upon any external signs of good luck. One doesn't rely upon any deities or divine beings to help one, but one cultivates the causes, the conditions for good fortune, for security, safety, well-being, prosperity, both mundane and spiritual, right here and now. And by cultivating the causes, one gains the effect. By establishing the conditions, one will reap the benefits that come when those conditions ripen. And as we see, causes that the Buddha will point to and the benefits are both mundane and supermundane. The Buddha doesn't teach just a supermundane doctrine of liberation from the world. And this is, I have to say, this is a very serious misunderstanding of the early Buddhist teaching. Many people think early Buddhism means just escaping the world and gaining nirvana. Mahayana Buddhism means practicing the Dharma in the world. But if we read the early Buddhist teaching, we see that the Buddha teaches one has to live and cultivate the Dharma in the world before one can gain ultimate liberation. And so the Buddha teaches both a path of, you might call this, mundane spiritual cultivation, the way to cultivate the Dhamma in the mundane aspects of one's day-to-day life. And he teaches the path that leads to final liberation. And the two are not just completely separate, but one blends into the other, merges with the other. So one has to cultivate the Dhamma, the principle of right conduct, right action, of wisdom in one's relations with one's family, one's relations with one's neighbors, one's community. One has to cultivate right attitudes of life in one's day-to-day activities. And then those right social relationships, right attitudes, will mature into the proper spiritual attitudes, which will mature into the factors of enlightenment, which will converge upon the path that leads to enlightenment and liberation. And so the Buddha begins at the very beginning. I said that the Mangala Sutta constitutes a complete education in the proper conduct of life. And so the Buddha begins in the first verse at the proper place to start. He says, Again, I'll start with read the Pali. Asevanacha balanam panditanancha sevana pujacha pujaniyanam etang mangalamuttamam. Okay, we read the translation. Not to associate with fools or foolish people, but to associate with the wise and to honor those who are worthy of honor. This is the most auspicious performance, for this is the greatest blessing, for this is the sign of good fortune. So we have here in this verse three mangalas indicated: avoiding association with foolish people. By association, what is meant is following them and serving them. Associating with wise people, following them, serving them, and honoring, respecting, venerating those who are worthy of honor, respect, and veneration. And these three mangalas, these three blessings, are all united around a common theme. They all form what we might call the proper orientation in the proper conduct of life. That is, they all serve to establish the basis for setting out in the right direction in life. And the way they unite in this way, the way they all contribute to forming the proper orientation, is that they help to establish within oneself a quality, a capacity, which we call discretion. This is an extremely important word. And it's very important for parents to cultivate this quality in their children. And it's important for us to cultivate it within ourselves all the time in our life. What is this quality called discretion? It means the capacity for valid moral judgment, the ability to distinguish what is wrong conduct, what is right conduct, the ability to distinguish what is good, what is bad, the ability to distinguish what are true values, what are false values, the ability to be able to see through sometimes the camouflage, the mirage of deceptive moral arguments, and to penetrate to true principles. It's the ability to resist the lure, the temptations of things that appear attractive, that appeal to our self-interest, but that might be ultimately harmful. And it's the ability to see that even though certain other courses of action might be difficult, challenging, demanding, that they are still the courses that we should follow for the very reason that they lead to our own true benefit and enable us to contribute most effectively to the true benefit of others. So this capacity for correct moral judgment, for evaluation, moral evaluation, this we could say is the light that will guide us through the whole course of our life. And the way this quality gets implanted within us depends to a very great extent upon whom we associate with. That is, this quality gets generated and cultivated through right association. This is why the Buddha, again and again in the discourses, emphasized the importance of avoiding bad friends, friends who pull us away from the right track, and cultivating kalyanamitta, good friendship, friendship with good friends, noble friends, who will lead us along the right path of life. Okay, and so we have this idea of right association presented here. First, the Buddha always proceeds in terms of what is to be avoided. One has to avoid association with the foolish. And this doesn't mean that from compassion one can and should associate with foolish people in order to guide them and correct them. But what is meant here by association is actually the word sevana. It's related to the English word serve. It means subordinating oneself to a person, placing oneself beneath the person, so that one looks up to that person as an example, as a guide, and one follows that person. This is what one wants to avoid in one's relations with foolish people. And so the question comes up, how does one know who is a foolish person? Okay, we have various criteria for determining. One criteria, the Buddha says, very, 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 very straightforward way. The fool is known through bad conduct of body, speech, and mind. So if we see people acting in unwholesome ways without showing any remorse or regret about their behavior, then we can know this person is foolish. But sometimes people determine their moral character from their outer behavior, but it's when we get to talk to them that we know what they really are inside. And one important criterion that the Buddha points out again and again are the views of this person, to see whether this person holds wrong views. If this person holds the view that there is no benefit at all, no value in practicing charity, in generosity, in giving to others, one should just live to get as much as one can for oneself, to enjoy for oneself. If this person thinks that there are no consequences of one's actions, that one could act in a reckless, destructive way and just laugh it off because what's done today vanishes today, tomorrow is a new day, and one doesn't have to face the consequences of one's action, then one can tell this person is a foolish person. And if one can see that this person has no sense of, there are two important qualities that are the foundations for morality, for all ethics, that is a sense of shame in doing wrong and the fear of doing wrong. If one sees that a person is completely shameless about killing, stealing, sexually reckless behavior, about lying, about self-indulgence in any way, then one realizes that this is a foolish person, and one should do best to keep a distance from that person. Okay, the reason for avoiding the foolish person, especially in the early days of one's cultivation, is because when one associates closely with the foolish person, becomes good friends with that person, then that person will influence you, and that person's qualities will spread, sometimes imperceptibly to yourself, until even sometimes without your knowing it, you come to absorb that person's qualities. And sometimes the person that we consider foolish doesn't have to have a repulsive personality. Sometimes they can have a very, very charming, radiant, delightful personality. This is what makes them so, sometimes, a dangerous type of person. Bright smile, friendly demeanor, warm greeting, always welcoming you. And then little by little, once the person gets to know you, then the person takes you into his confidence and starts gradually corrupting you and twisting your own mind to fit his way of thinking. And so once you see that that person is a foolish person, one without a sense of shame, without moral dread, one with wrong views, and one who is ready to lead you down self-destructive paths, then it's wise to keep a distance from that person. Okay, then, the counterpart to this now, panditanam cha sevana, that is, to serve, to follow, to associate with the wise people. And how does one know who is the wise person? Again, that same text says, wisdom shines forth in conduct. And so the minimal requirement for judging who is a wise person is the person should be one who behaves rightly by body, speech, and mind. That is not really enough to tell if the person is truly wise, but if the person behaves rightly, one could see that this is a person that you can associate with. Then through getting to know that person, you can learn that person's views, and one can see if that person holds right views. Then when you know that the person holds right views, then you can associate closely with that person. Then there are different ways of associating with the wise. It's important to know this, because this will help one to cultivate close association with the wise. Once you see that certain persons are wise, then you should try to meet them frequently. Don't impose upon them, but whenever there's an opportunity, you should meet them. When they need some help, then try to help them, be willing to help them. And one important way within the Indian tradition of helping the wise person, this is the way a student becomes bound to a teacher, is by presenting a gift to the teacher. And then by presenting the gift, we call dana, it's a way of supporting the teacher and showing that one is ready to open oneself to learn from the teacher. But then it's not enough simply to meet with the wise person, to help them, to present them with gifts, but to absorb their wisdom, one should listen to their teachings. But don't just listen passively. Listening is only the first step. Because the true wise person doesn't want just blind followers. But the wise person will want pupils who, after listening to his teachings, will examine the teachings, investigate them, and will be ready to ask questions. Because a wise person wants his or her students to become wise people in turn. And it's through examining the teachings and asking questions that the student's wisdom will develop. Then you ask questions. When you have the opportunity, you meet with the wise person to discuss the Dhamma, either in the sense of the Buddha's teaching, or else to ask other issues, other maybe more personal questions on which you might need advice from a wise person. And then the most important thing, once you feel that the wise person is somebody truly trustworthy, and you have heard the teachings and accepted them, then practice in accordance with their advice. In this way, you will be able to develop the wisdom within yourself. There are some nice verses that come in the work called the Itivutaka. It's a collection of texts, or a collection of short suttas. These are verses on the dangers of associating with the foolish person and the benefits of associating with the wise person. The verse says, whatever person one makes friends with, whomever one associates with, one becomes of like quality. One becomes like one's companion. The follower and the followed are like an arrow coated with poison that contaminates its quiver. Fearing contamination, the wise person should not have bad friends. Then comes a simile. A man who ties up putrid fish with blades of kusa grass. Kusa grass, it's a type of grass that grows in India. It has a sweet scent. And it's used for religious purposes. Usually the yogis use them to make mats for meditation or huts for meditation. And they use them in religious rituals. The Brahmins use kusa grass. So a man who ties up putrid fish with blades of kusa grass makes the kusa grass smell foul. So it is with those who follow fools. If one follows foolish people, if one subordinates oneself to them, the qualities of that foolish person pass over to oneself. But a person who wraps tagara powder, tagara powder, it's a powder with a very sweet fragrance. A man who wraps up tagara powder in the broad leaf of a tree makes the leaf smell fragrant. So it is with those who follow sages, who follow the wise. Therefore, understanding the outcome for oneself, one should not follow those deficient in virtues. Instead, one should follow the wise and virtuous person. the unvirtuous person leads one to the lower realms of rebirth. The virtuous help one to the higher realms. Okay, so I've listed here some of the benefits of associating with the wise. And now I come to the third of the blessings or causes of good fortune, that is to honor those who are worthy of honor. This is puja cha pujaniyam cha etam mangalamuttamam. Okay, since in the Buddhist tradition, we pay honor to those who are considered worthy of honor, worthy of respect, worthy of veneration. And the person who is most worthy of veneration is the Buddha himself, who is the embodiment of all most excellent qualities. Then just below the Buddha comes the Aryan Sangha. This is the spiritual community of noble disciples, say the arahants, bodhisattvas who have reached the stages of definite attainment, those who are irreversible, who have achieved the wisdom, compassion, pure ethical practice, and are definitely on the way to enlightenment and liberation. Then conventionally within Buddhist society, one pays veneration and respect to the monastic sangha. Even though individual monks might have their own faults and defects, but one pays veneration to the monastic sangha as representing in visible form the Aryan sangha, the noble sangha. Then, and this is very important in binding together a society into an integral whole, children should show respect to their parents and to the elders of the family. In a traditional society, children even worship the parents, bowing down to them, but doing gestures we call namaskara or anjali to the parents. What's happened, I have to say, under the impact of democracy, children think, we're as good as parents. Parents think, we have to treat the children as good as us, as equal to ourselves. And so the parents and children become buddy-buddy. And then that relationship of respect breaks down. And with that, the whole society eventually, the moral fabric of society gets eroded. Then one shows respect to even secular teachers who have virtuous qualities and right view. And there are many other people to whom we show respect. At work, one shows respect toward one's employer. And then within the Buddhist tradition, there are objects worthy of honor and respect. In Buddhist countries, we have dagobas, stupas, chaityas, pagodas, which often they contain the relics of the Buddha, bodily relics, the relics of great monks, great masters. And so one pays respect to these objects as representing, we could say, the presence of the sacred within the worldly domain. We also show respect to Dhamma books. We don't put Dhamma books underneath secular books. And we don't put Dhamma books on the floor. We don't step on them. And we should treat them with respect because they are embodiments of the Dhamma, of the Buddha himself, you could say. There are different ways to show respect. These are important things to learn. And in a Buddhist country, when the sutta is taught to children, it's a way of imparting to them the basic, you could say, the principles of etiquette, of Buddhist etiquette, so that they grow up with these gestures and means of etiquette throughout their whole life. So when one comes to the Buddha image, say, one will bow down to it and show veneration towards it. Within the Sangha, within the Buddhist country, lay people bow down to the monks, even though the monk might be very ordinary, but they bow down to the monks because the monk is representing symbolically the noble Sangha, the Aryan Sangha. Within the monastic Sangha, every monk bows down to the monks who are senior to him. So, for example, living in Sri Lanka, if I meet a monk for the first time, we will ask, when were you ordained? If he says 1973, then we say, what month were you ordained? He might say, May. Okay, then we say, what day in May were you ordained? If he says May 20th, then I will say, what time were you ordained? If he says, I was ordained in the morning, then I will say, please have a seat, venerable sir. He will take the seat, I will take my cloth, and bow down to him. If he says in the evening of May 20th, then I will remain sitting there and say, you can show respect, friend. Then he will take his cloth and he will show respect. And so this is a way, it might just seem like an empty formality, but it generates an attitude of respect and veneration. Okay, so there's not only these outward acts. Okay, one way is this bowing down. We call it vandana. Then there is the act of anjali, also called namaskara, joining the hands together and bowing the head like this. Another sign of respect or veneration is offering gifts, sometimes just a little gift, sometimes just symbolically. Sometimes often in a Buddhist country, when lay people go to visit a monastery, they'll sometimes bring just a little bundle of fruit just to offer to the chief monk. And then most important is mental esteem and showing active concern for the people. And then the advantages of showing respect. Advantages for ourselves is that it helps, this is very important, to diminish self-love, arrogance, and pride. This is a really great benefit, because when one practices bowing and showing respect, it just puts one's pride right down on the bottom. Like, okay, I first went to Sri Lanka in 1972. I came there after teaching in a college for 2 years with PhD in philosophy. I got ordained. I met samaneras who were little boys. I was a samanera, little boys who were 12 years old, 14 years old. They were ordained before I was. So when it comes to the bowing, and these are village boys just coming, sometimes not even ordaining voluntarily, but their parents give them to the temple to get ordained. But since they are ordained before I was, I have to swallow all of my doctorate in philosophy pride, coming from the West, bow down to them. But I found very beneficial sitting at the end of a line with these little samaneras this high sitting in front of me. But because I was over 20, I was 27, 28, I got full ordination. So after May 73, I go ahead of them. They have to wait another 7-8 years before they can get full ordination. Okay, so it helps to diminish self-love, arrogance, pride. And in doing so, it makes the mind feel very light and bright. And in showing respect, developing an attitude of respect wins the admiration of people who are wise and worthy. We don't want to win the admiration of foolish people. Maybe foolish people show you, if they see you showing respect and veneration to religious people, to renunciants, they'll think, what is he doing? He could be out having a good time enjoying himself. Why waste time showing respect and veneration to these empty-headed renunciants? But those who are truly wise and worthy people will admire those who show respect and veneration to those who are truly worthy. And then showing respect and veneration, that will serve to awaken, to stimulate the seeds of wisdom in our own minds. This is somewhat like using a magnifying glass to focus the heat of the sun in order to light a fire. If we don't use the magnifying glass, we can have the sun burning and blazing all day long, but the fuel that we collect won't catch fire. And so we can have the Buddha, we could have these reading his teachings, studying his teachings from morning to night. But if we don't have that attitude of respect and veneration to the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, then the wisdom of the Buddha won't be able to ignite the fire of wisdom in our own mind. But it is when we have this right attitude of veneration, respect, that our own mind becomes like the magnifying glass. Then the light of the Buddha's teaching can come into the mind, penetrate deep into the heart, and ignite the fire of wisdom so it can burn bright and clear. Okay, so putting all of these factors together, the Buddha says that avoiding association with the foolish, keeping clear of foolish people. Now we're at the beginning of our spiritual development. We're not like Vimalakirti, who could go to the gambling houses, they call them the taverns, brothels, in order to convert the deluded people onto the right path. But we're just rather feeble, weak, starting out on our spiritual path. So we have to be very careful. So we avoid the taverns, we avoid the gambling houses, we avoid the brothels. We avoid the places, the sports arenas where people gather to enjoy themselves, the nightclubs. I used to say discotheques till Marcy told me I was in Sri Lanka too long, that they know you're longer speak of discotheques anymore. Okay, we avoid places where foolish people gather. We associate with the wise. We connect with them. We try to learn from the wise. And we show honor and veneration to those who are worthy of veneration. To these three measures, then we are developing this capacity for discretion, for making independent moral judgments, ethical judgments. We are developing within our own minds that light of right understanding that can guide us along the path of life. Okay, so this is the first verse of the Mangala Sutta. I thank you all for your attention, and may the blessings of the Triple Gem be with you all. Okay, we will share the merits. Could we think of all of the beings in other realms of existence, as well as our own departed relatives and friends? And since we've been listening to the Dhamma, speaking the Dhamma, we share these merits with them, wishing for their welfare and happiness. Akasata chapumata devanagamahitika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasata chapumata devanagamahitika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasata chapumata devanagamahitika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu mamparam. Etavata chamhehi sampadam punya sampadam. Sabbe deva numodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata chamhehi sampadam punya sampadam. Sabbe bhuta numodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata chamhehi sampadam tam punya sampadam sabbe satanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.